Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thank you, Tim.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Okay, now it's my turn. We're rolling. 109 John Williams in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Come by and wave. I'll wave back. Although it's not much fun today, I'll tell you what, it's kind of gloomy, kind of cool, a little breezy downtown. I'm bumming it down the town. However, we will be your bright spot, sunny and warm, with chatty conversation this afternoon, all the way until 3 o'clock. Scott Simon, who wrote the book My Cubs, A Love Story, is in our studio in the 2 o'clock hour. Looking forward to his visit here. We'll also play for you some of the audio from the Sally Yates testimony and talk a little bit about that. One of the interesting things that came out of Yates' testimony is the sidebar conversation, if you will, between her and Senator Ted Cruz, where they were talking not about General Flynn and whether or not he was compromised. They were talking rather about, what was that little clip that we're going to play?
Well, they were talking about her basically defying the president by...
The immigration order.
Yeah, about the immigration order, because on the grounds of it being unconstitutional, that's what she argues.
And it's very interesting because the rules about that say that the president, if he feels there's a threat, can kick anybody out or not allow anybody in. And yet at the same time, the same language in, not in the Constitution, obviously, but in law or in procedures, there's language that also says that the government, the president cannot discriminate based on religious grounds. But it also says that if he feels that a group can be injurious to the United States, then he has the right to and should. So you have these sort of conflicting pieces of language. And the two of them were brilliant. I do not want to go up against Ted Cruz. That guy is good. He's good on stage. You may not like him, but he's good on stage. So there he is. And then she is up to the task. And it was a very interesting civil exchange. We'll play after 2 o'clock. Rex Hupke is going to join us in the studio after 1:30. He has written in the past about the cost of Trump travel. I hesitate to go down this path because I think there are some things that are not important enough, given all that's going on, for us to talk about. But once in a while, it's okay to dip your toe in those waters and just wade around a little bit. And the Trump travel costs are a story in the news this week. That comes your way after 1:30. A friend of mine was getting gas in Rockford, pulled up to a station. Kim, you're a bright person. You do the news, and you're able to drive an automobile, correct?
I try.
Have you ever put the wrong fuel in your car?
No.
I don't think I have either. I think maybe once I put a higher octane, or when I was driving a Mercedes, a lower octane than I should have. But either way, it was...
Right, that's not going to stop your car.
And it wasn't diesel, but a friend of mine put E80 in there. She put E80
That's
in there.
That's the ethanol?
I guess. So she puts the E80 in there. She's at a station, and it's the middle one. You know, so she thought she'd get the middle octane, but in fact, she was getting the ethanol. And so she grabs the thing, puts it in there. Look. That's her car drinking ethanol. And then she takes off. And like seconds later, the car just stops. No acceleration. It will not go. Car is dead. She has it towed. And $1,000 later, they say, lady, if you put E80 in your car, this is what can happen. She's driving about a 10-year-old Honda SUV.
Is it run forever?
Yeah, it's been a good car.
Oh, boy.
This has never happened before. Here's my question for you. My number is 312-981-7200. What happened? Are you telling me that if I accidentally, because you'll see the ethanol blends there, in this case it was E80, 85, E80, 85, whatever it takes. If you make that mistake, does that kill your car?
Well, and also, if it does kill your car, I mean, who's going
to
pay for this?
You want to go back to the gas
station's fault, right? Because maybe that pump should not fit into your car.
That is the solution. But she said, you know, like when you do the diesel, if you've ever grabbed that, it's not compatible or it's not easy to get the fuel in there. So if this is a problem for that fuel with all cars or some cars, presumably not all cars, but some cars, Otherwise, why would they have it? There should be a physical solution to this.
Absolutely.
She does not feel like she was had. That is taken by the mechanics who said, hey, lady, we'll tow your car and then we got to change out your spark plugs and drain the fuel and put in the new stuff. I don't know what all happens. I know they had to change them. If cars still have spark plugs, I think they had to change those out. Not real sharp car. Do cars still have spark plugs?
I have no idea.
Right. They had to do some stuff. She then called her mechanic, and it's a person that she trusts, and she says, this is what's happening to my car. And they go, yeah, that's what happens. In fact, when she called her mechanic friend, and the mechanic has no skin in the game. They're not getting paid because the car's not there. But she said, hey, I put E80 in my car and it died. And they just go, oh, boy. Oh, boy. And they say every week or two they get a call like this from somebody who's put the
wrong. Well, something's got to change. That's crazy. Okay. And I know that E80 is getting more and more popular.
I think it's a thing.
It's always becoming a problem, obviously.
Well, maybe not. I mean, I always thought that was something you should put in your car. It's good for the farmers. I think it's supposed to be, if not more efficient, more environmentally friendly.
How do you know your car is E80 compatible?
All right, let's find out. Somebody answer that question. Elif and I dialed around on that today on the interwebs, and we found no easy source for information on that. And even if it says, well, this is the preferred one, they'll do that with motor oils and should you get 88 or 90 or 92 octane. But you would think that there would not be sitting there an option that will just render your car inoperable.
Right.
Like it'll run less efficient. But really? That can happen? Now, Richard says he knows something about this. Hey, Richard, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually just spoke to Bill and Wendy a couple hours ago when they were talking about the lawsuit for the Chicago Bulls worker.
I heard your voice. You're good.
Yeah. I am an adjuster for an insurance company. And let me tell you what has happened to the engine and why. The engine will cut itself off when it has a foreign matter in it. There are safeguards in it. So that's why she started it up. He or she started up the vehicle, drove it a little ways, and then it just cut off. Now, that doesn't mean that there's $0 in damage. There is damage, and it can be rectified, you know, for, depending upon what it is, for between $400 and $1,000. It may need a new fuel filter. It may need a new fuel tank, but as long as it hasn't, you know, completely worked its way through the entire engine, and, you know, doesn't need to have the whole, you know, engine pulled out and a new engine put in, it's fine. It can be fixed.
Well, this wasn't root beer. I mean, how the heck is it that they're selling something that if you make that mistake, it can lead to this?
Well, that I don't know. I don't know how and why they sell it. I do know that when it does happen, though, it is a covered loss. I would say have your friend, you know, as long as they have invoices on what happened.
No
that,
kidding.
That reflects what happened.
Really?
That's claimable, yeah. It's claimable, and it's no different from, say, some punk kid putting a candy bar in your fuel tank. It's a foreign matter that is not supposed to be in the vehicle.
Yeah, but all right, well, that's okay, but that's interesting enough. But I mean, still, do you understand my point? That doesn't sound like a foreign material to me. It sounds like fuel. You just made a mistake. You put the wrong one in there. But
wrong one in it. Yeah, you're right.
So I guess that makes it a foreign material. I mean, the car isn't supposed to have it. But do you share my surprise that a mistake that simple could lead to something that problematic?
I share your surprise that I didn't realize that the nozzle would fit into the fuel tank of just a regular internal combustion. Because, you know, if it is a diesel engine or a diesel fuel nozzle, it's not going to fit.
Right.
It's going to be different. You're not going to put it in, and you're going to look down and say, why the hell isn't this going in? And then you're going to realize, I grabbed the diesel nozzle.
I think I've done that before, and I went, oh, okay, thank you. Thank you. And then I said, thank you, nozzle. That's what I said. I said, thank you, nozzle.
Right.
But she did not.
I don't know why it wouldn't have that with
the
E80.
Oh.
Weird.
Okay. Well, that's helpful. So I'll tell her to at least claim it, if nothing else.
Yeah.
Her deductible's probably $1,000, but whatever.
As long as she's got a pretty decent insurance company, even if she's already gotten the work done, we pay claims all the time where something like this happens. A person gets the work done. They don't realize it's something that they could have claimed, you know, much like, you know, driving over a pot, hitting a pothole or having their catalytic converter stolen and they just take it somewhere and get it replaced. And, you know, it costs a lot of money. more than their deductible. They don't realize they have a claim, but they do. So have her make a claim, and worst case scenario, if her company denies it, they deny it, and she's no worse off.
Okay, you're not an automotive expert. You're an insurance guy. Here's the last question for you, though. So for what cars is that a good fuel to use? I mean, there must be some out there.
I have no clue. And I've seen there are a lot of cars, vehicles, American cars mostly, that are flex fuel compatible.
Yeah.
And you may see that little tag on the trunk lid if you're like driving behind someone. It'll say flex fuel. But by and large, I don't see it very often. And I've never had a situation where somebody put E80 into their tank and then messed up their car. I have seen someone try to, you know, force the oily slick diesel into their car.
Just stand there and hose her down. Just give her a good shot. I put motor oil into the transmission one time. Thought I was being pretty handy, and so I thought top off the oil, and I accidentally poured it into the transmission. And actually, my transmission didn't seem to mind. But so I'm sure this has happened before, where people put the wrong thing in the wrong place. But I haven't heard this before. Listen, you've been real helpful. Thanks for calling again, Richard. Roe will be on at 3. Call him after 3 o'clock, okay?
Depends on the topic. I'll call him. Thanks, guys.
Have a good day. It's 1:20. So you're familiar with the Jimmy Kimmel story, right? Cochran played a little bit about it this morning. I want to play just a little bit different and longer segment. But Kimmel's son was diagnosed shortly after he was born with a congenital heart disease. And he got it fixed, and the kid lives, and Jimmy gave that tearful monologue the other night, and we were all really touched by it. But now he's taking some flack. No good deed goes unpunished, right? So if you say thank you to the doctors, and here's what happened to me, and isn't it a wonderful story, you're going to get beat up, particularly since at the end he called out President Trump and the Congress and said, let's not make the lives of babies dependent upon who has the most money. Everybody should get the same good care that my kid got, and I don't think everybody does. Let's not, he said, turn this into a sporting event. We don't have teams here. We're all on the same side. Let's do what's right for families and kids and get them affordable health care. That was his peel. But boy, did he take it. And so he gave it back last night. Was it last night or the night before? I think it was last night, right? We'll get to that in a minute.
So.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute here on WGN. Jimmy Kimmel's emotional monologue last week, says Time Magazine, a teary-eyed retelling of his newborn son's open-heart surgery and a moving appeal for equal access to health care was viewed by millions and met mostly with praise. There were, however, a few detractors.
I know this is going to shock you. There were also some not-so-nice things that people said online about me, including members of the media. Now, this is a real headline from the New York Post, Jimmy Kimmel's obscene lies about kids and medical care. This is from something called the Washington Times. I don't think it's a real newspaper, but shut up, Jimmy Kimmel, you elitist creep. I cannot count the number of times I've been called an out-of-touch Hollywood elitist. And I would like to apologize for saying that children in America should have health care. It was insensitive. It was offensive, and I hope you can find it in your heart to forgive me. There are some very sick and sad people out there. Here's one of them. His name is Newt Gingrich. He's the former Speaker of the House.
If you show up at a hospital with a brand new baby and the brand new baby has a heart problem, the doctors at that hospital do everything they can to save the baby. They don't say, we'll take care of the baby right after you write a check. They try to save the baby's life. And that's true across the board in this country.
Yes, it is true that if you have an emergency, they will do an operation, and that's terrific if your baby's health problems are all solved during that one visit. The only problem is that never, ever happens. We've had a dozen doctor's appointments since our son had surgery. You've got a cardiologist, a pediatrician, surgeon. Some kids need an ambulance to transport them. That doesn't even count the parents who have to miss work for all this stuff. Those details Newt forgot to mention. I don't know if the double layers of Spanx are restricting the blood flow to his brain, but... And not only is Newt Gingrich an expert on sick children, turns out he also knows a thing or two about the late-night comedy business.
The problem you have with humor in America today...
Okay, yes. Please tell us the problem we have with humor in America today.
The problem you have with humor in America today is that Hollywood is so enraged at Donald Trump that they can't be funny. All they've got is pure anger. And that's what's coming out in this stuff. And then they think it must be funny because they're called comedians, so they exhibit their anger as almost a pathology. on late night television, and you're supposed to laugh because after all, they're comedians. They ain't funny because they're too angry to be funny.
Gee, I wonder why we're so angry. Maybe it has something to do with, I don't know, you? Listen, I don't want to... Newt Gingrich does know a lot about comedy. This is a man, this is the guy who helped lead the impeachment effort against Bill Clinton for trying to cover up his affair while he was having an affair.
We know, we remember. You know, he may have a point there. Maybe Newt's got a point, too. Actually, I think Newt does have a point in that what's happening on Jimmy Kimmel's show and Jimmy Fallon's show and Stephen Colbert's show is not funny to Newt Gingrich and may not be funny to a lot of conservatives. I hate to see it all devolve into that. Now, the late night shows, if Jimmy goes there, are going to be the late night equivalent of, say, the comments pages under newspaper stories, where somebody will say, well, I think the president is right, or somebody will say, I think the president is wrong. And then you all just hate each other in the comment stream all the way down until finally they cut it or you off. And I don't want that to happen.
But he wasn't political in his original statement. I was thinking of this the other day because you played it before. What he did was advocate a position.
Jimmy Kimmel.
I mean, he didn't say the Republicans are bad or the Democrats are good. He kind of put it on both parties. So what he did was advocate a position that was up for debate in the country, right?
He was saying that all children should have affordable health care.
Right. And so the question was affordable, was pre-existing conditions. And he said that they should be covered. So it's something we all should be debating. He took a position on it. It wasn't an overly...
Well, did you think that Jimmy's position was more favorable to one side than the other?
Well, I don't know. I guess that's the thing I'm trying to separate with. I mean, we want to be engaged. You want people to have informed opinions about issues, right? So that was his. Can he not say anything? Because if he does, it's going to be seen as taking one side or another?
I'm not saying that he went over the top, but I'm also saying I'm not surprised that he's getting some of the backlash that he got. I'm not surprised. Are you that he's getting the backlash that he got?
Nothing surprises me.
Well, okay, but my point is that I do think he made it sound like this is Donald Trump and the Republicans' problems. And he was asking all of Congress and all of us to do what's right for all of the kids. And he said, it's not baseball. We don't have teams. Let's not work against each other. But I think we know what team he's on.
I know, but he didn't single out Donald. No, I might be wrong, but I don't
He mentioned the president at the beginning.
Or the Republicans. He didn't. What I'm saying is he advocated a position on an issue that we were debating. And
okay.
If you can't do that without being called, you know, a political hack, then we can't do it on any issue.
Fair enough, but now you're in the mud with him. Now you're saying that, now you're monologuing about what a doof Newt Gingrich is, and that's what Donald Trump does to all of us. I hate to, Steve, do you see my point?
I hate to see
it go there.
It just struck me back at the original thing that it's like, well, you can't take a position without being accused of being a political hack, and we should be able to separate those a little bit.
It's 1:30. We'll get you the news next, and then Rex Hubke, the columnist for the Tribune, who appears on this station not infrequently, has something to say. I asked him to join us about the travel costs for the first family. Thanks, Steve. It's 1:39. Scott Simon wrote a really touching book about the World Series last year. It's not a long book. It's not 150 pages, and the pages aren't very long, but it says a lot. I'm a fan of the book, and you probably know who he is from NPR's Saturday edition and kind of a staple on the Chicago scene. He's going to be in our studio, and he's also doing the thing at Lit Fest, so he's going to come by and talk a little Cubs with us, and that story that he tells in our 2 o'clock hour. So this is from this is the New York Times story. It says, on Thursday evening before Easter, photographers staking out Palm Beach International Airport in Florida, awaiting President Donald Trump, were surprised to see not one but two Air Force planes arriving within minutes of each other. Shortly before the president landed, Melania Trump arrived on a Boeing C-32, a military version of a 757, with their 11-year-old son, Barron, and other family members to spend the holiday at the Mar-a-Lago Golf Resort. Her one-way trip from New York, where she lives separately from her husband so their son can finish the school year, cost taxpayers more than $110,000. It says here it's a unique set of circumstances that has made the current president a presidential family the most expensive in history. There is no standard methodology to tally travel and protection costs, but based on publicly available information reviewed by the Los Angeles Times, the total for Trump's first 100 days was at least $30 million. By comparison, the conservative think tank Judicial Watch found that costs for President Barack Obama and his much smaller family averaged $12 million a year. $12 million a year for the Obamas. So far, in 100 days, $30 million for the Trump's larger family. In the federal budget compromise reached last week, Congress allocated an extra $61 million to reimburse the New York and Palm Beach cities for some of the expenses incurred since the election to protect the first family. The jump in cost is largely because Trump has used three separate residences, the White House, Trump Tower, Mar-a-Lago in Florida, and now over the weekend he's added a fourth, his Bedminster, New Jersey golf club. The Secret Service guards five children, their three spouses, and eight grandchildren, 16 people in all. Each protectee, as the Secret Service calls them, gets his or her own security detail even when they all travel together. The New York Police Department wrote in a letter to Congress that it was spending $127,000 to $146,000 a day, that's the New York City Police Department, to secure Donald Trump's building in New York, the Midtown Manhattan skyscraper, Trump Tower, in addition to the $4.5 million that the fire department will spend this year on security there. Mar-a-Lago is another big expense. Palm Beach County says its overtime runs $60,000 a day when Trump is visiting and was $250,000 for the weekend when the Chinese president joined. Since taking office, Donald Trump has spent seven weekends at that resort, each trip costing at least $1 million, with some estimates running up to $3.6 million. So there's that. My problem with all of this is that I'm not still sure if we should care about that. If, okay, that's an interesting story, we don't have to make much out of it. I generally ignore this kind of a story. But Rex Hupke wrote about something like this some time ago, and he and I had a conversation about that, and I asked him to join me back again this afternoon. Hey, Rex, it's John. How are you?
Great, John. How are you doing?
Pretty good. So the thing with a story like this to me, Rex, is there are so many stories like this. Ivanka profiting, the Kushners selling visas for $500,000. There's just a whole bunch of other stories, however interesting, are also unkind to the first family. And I wonder how to budget either my time on the radio or my mental energy on these things. How do you manage it, Rex Hupke?
Yes, well, I have begun doing transcendental meditation to try to calm myself from time to time.
Do you see my point that I wonder if we should all pause and go, okay, but let's not talk about that. That's really not as important as the tax plan.
Here's where I differentiate the two. And yes, I mean, there are many, many things relating to politics in general, not specifically Trump, but politics in general that we should all be focusing on. However, I think that, and I've argued that this is substantial and different and frankly, different from any past president for a number of different reasons, and I can kind of outline them a little bit here. And I think the primary reason that this matters, and I think is a very significant issue, whether it's where Trump is going on his weekends, et cetera, or what his family members are doing, is that he personally and his family is profiting from these things. I mean, that's I don't believe you can say at this point that that's can be argued. I mean, the rates down at Mar-a-Lago have doubled. The membership rates have doubled from 100,000 to 200,000.
Yeah.
The boy Eric and
Donald Jr.
Yeah, Donald Jr. Eric and other one. Now Eric and Donald Jr. have both made comments about how business is booming in Trump world. Since the election and since he became president. So he is constantly drawing attention to his own properties, to his own brand, and also to avenues by which rich and powerful people can gain access. And I think the visa issue with Jared Kushner's family's business over in China the other day, where they were doing a promotional bid to wealthy Chinese investors, trying to say, look, you can get a visa if you invest $500,000 into this project, blah, blah, blah. That's pretty, I mean, to be honest, it's almost shockingly blatant in terms of
it. It was on the placard in the hotel lobby. It was shockingly blatant.
They had a picture.
I'm still not sure that matters. So, to me, that's not that different from Donald Trump's taxes. Maybe he's benefiting. Maybe he's benefiting a lot. I'm still not sure we need to worry about it.
I don't know why we wouldn't worry about that. That couldn't. So you were basically selling, and keep in mind too, a lot of the arguments made during the election about Hillary Clinton's ties to various places through the Clinton Foundation, which again, the Clinton Foundation was a philanthropic organization that did a tremendous amount of good, and you know had a you know in, and was reviewed, was public, all the books were open, et cetera. So, you know, this is one of the big things we were arguing about during the election.
I know that, but the election's over. But
even regardless,
the election's over. Hillary is not a factor any more than you like it when Trump says, I beat Hillary by a lot. I don't think we need to use Hillary's example as a defense for attacking Donald Trump.
It's not using Hillary's example. It's simply saying, why did it matter then and it doesn't matter now? And I think it absolutely matters because what you're talking about is access to the most powerful person in,
okay, now you're on to
in the world.
Now you're on to something.
Now, so you're talking about, you know, who knows? We don't know what all the ties are. We have no clue because of the lack of transparency on the part of both Trump and the Trump Corporation. So we don't really know. And this could all be, first of all, let me say, this could all be very easily cleared up, or at least, you know, a good part of it could be cleared up if he would release his tax returns and show all of the widespread entanglements. And frankly, I think a lot of people would even, you know, understanding that he does have, I mean, he's a unique person. He has a massive international business and brand. So there are going to be entanglements. If we could just know what those are and be able to sift through it, see where, you know, has he gotten, you know, there people have talked about, you know, bailouts from Russian banks during a particularly low point in his business's run. I mean, we just don't know. And so without knowing that, it makes all of this.
I get your point.
Much more fishy. I don't think, look, I mean, I just don't. I know we talked about this before. I think protection of a president and his or her family is imperative. And the cost of that protection, in a general sense, at least, it should not be an issue. And as far as regular travel, you know, that's all fine. But there are a couple things that are very different here. And I think the number one thing is that the places he is traveling to and his family is traveling to are – he is benefiting from that. We have, you know, the Secret Service – paying his companies for golf carts and for, you know, room and, you know, all these sorts of things. So this is a big, I mean, there's a lot going on here. And another thing that I think is.
Okay. Hold on 1 second. Okay. I'll let you finish that thought. I still think though that the travel expense issue is emblematic of exactly what I'm trying to talk about. His taxes may show some ties and it may show how he's crafting deals that will benefit him. And maybe we should know that because not because he profits, but because U.S. policy changes. But I don't see how U.S. policy changes with respect to his travel expenses. And to me, that is the best example of a quote-unquote news story that I think is interesting and should be reported, but is really difficult to put into some sort of perspective. We'll pick it up here in a minute, and I know some of you have some comments for Rex Hupke, too. It's 1:50 on WGN. I'm annoying Rex Hupke from the Chicago Tribune.
And perpetually annoyed.
And WGN Radio about how we decide how to cover and talk about some of the Trump habits and costs and stories. I cut you off before the break. Finish that, and then I want to take a question or comment from a couple callers.
Sure. I think another factor here that makes this significant, the costs that we're talking about, is the fact he ran on this populist platform. He ran on his own extreme wealth, and now he appears to be sort of taking people for a bit of a ride here. I mean, and I think that's significant because, again, he constantly talks about the forgotten person and all of this stuff. But we're talking about a person who griped endlessly about Obama's travel, and now he's, you know, tripling easily that while lining his own pockets in the process. And so I just think that there is the entire dynamic of what's happening here is flies in the face of much of what he stood for in his campaign and still sort of purports to stand for. And again, I mean, it's not in the grand scheme of things, as far as the government money, government expenditures go, is this a massive amount? No, it's not. But at the same time, it's sending a message. And I think it's sending a kind of galling message to a lot of people. And I would think to a lot of his supporters, too, because seriously, I mean, he's, you know, he's ringing up serious debt.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. What do you think his supporters? No, hold on. Hold on. What do you think his supporters think about all of this?
His hardest core supporters don't care, but I do think that there's people that supported him who have to be looking at this.
Have you heard from those people? Because I have not.
Not really, no. I haven't. But I just find it hard.
But they have to be out there. The chances are
they're... I hold out hope that, I mean, I just don't see how you don't look at this and see a scam artist at work. I mean, that's what's happening when it comes to his business entanglements and what this is doing to promote him and his family. Again, protect him, protect his entire family. Absolutely. I think that's fundamentally important. And every president is going to travel and the first lady is going to travel. I think that's all legitimate. But I think you have to look at where this travel is occurring, why it's occurring. I mean, these aren't even vacations. He's literally just leaving the White House because he wants to go down there.
There's two mysterious groups out there that I've never heard from, and I know they're out there. It's like dark matter. You know it exists, but we don't have any evidence of it. One is, how about that for a sort of highfalutin reference? One is people who liked Obamacare, and the other one is the Trump supporters who are now upset with the ongoing parade of ridiculous, and I don't hear from them. I don't hear from them. I want to talk to Joyce real quick, and then we got to wrap it up. Joyce, give us your quick question or comment. What was that?
Oh, I'm on. Okay. Well, I just think that I'm a staunch Republican until this year when I heard before the election that Trump might have any doings with Russia. And I just think that it's deplorable what he's doing with the traveling. I think he's taken the American people for a ride, and we should not put up with it. And his adult children should not be covered on America's budget, because if they feel in danger, they have money to pay for it.
Hold on a second. I want to give Rex's... Thank you, Joyce. And what do you know? There's one. Do you and I agree, Joyce doesn't, that the government should pay for the protection of his adult children?
Yeah, no, I do. I think that's part of the deal. I think that for somebody who, again, ran on his extreme wealth, it would be symbolically a very nice gesture if he was to actually pay for some of this, including the fact that his wife is living separately from him in New York for their own convenience so that Barron can finish the school year out there, et cetera. And that's costing a fortune. So I guess, you know, again, someone who paints himself as a billionaire without ever releasing tax returns to show it, and then I just feel like as part of this image that he tried to promote of himself as this great wealthy populist who cares about the forgotten man, mm-hmm. Why is he not doing anything to cover maybe some of these costs while he's raking in, you know, untold amounts of money off of the free promotion and various other things? I don't think that's an unreasonable thing to ask.
I'm out of time. You going to be on the radio anytime soon here?
We're doing, we do our podcast. Yeah, we have our podcast every Wednesday, Amy Guth and I, Guth and Hupke on Politics. And we'll be doing that and doing lots of yelling and screaming and occasional incantations and whatnot. So.
We'll listen then.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
Appreciate and we'll it. Read you too. That's Rex Hupke.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Doing my best.
Here's John Williams.
Here I am. It's 2:09. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Scott Simon's got a new book about the Chicago Cubs. Imagine that. And we'll talk to him in about 15 minutes. In the meantime, go to Washington, D.C. Tal Copen is a political reporter for CNN Politics. Previously, Tal worked at Fox News Chicago and ABC 7 as well. Tal, you're on WGN Radio. How are you this afternoon?
Hi, I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about what's happening with the Sally Yates hearing today. What has the headline been, or were there any bombshells?
Yeah, so, you know, she testified for several hours yesterday evening, and so today we're sort of in the fallout stream of that testimony. And, you know, the White House daily briefing just wrapped up, and a ton of questions were about her testimony. You know, I don't know that there were any bombshells necessarily. She didn't come, you know, armed with a smoking gun, as I've seen written. But she certainly laid out a very interesting timeline. And one of the biggest takeaways, and now the biggest question for the White House, is that she first came to the White House, you know, with concerns about Michael Flynn possibly being compromised by the Russians. And he wasn't fired until 18 days later, after it was made public by the media that he had lied to the vice president. And so the big question that comes out of her testimony is why the White House waited those 18 days before firing Michael Flynn after she first flagged an issue.
Are we getting an answer to that yet?
So Sean Spicer was asked this in several different ways in the daily press briefing today, and he noted that there were some things that happened in the interim. She was asked for some follow-up information. The White House counsel wanted to see for himself some of the transcripts of exactly what the U.S. government was able to hear in some of the calls that Michael Flynn had with the Russian officials. But there is not a clear explanation coming out yet why those, you know, subsequent days after those transcripts were reviewed and after this concern was made were waited. And there weren't clear answers about why Michael Flynn was allowed to continue with some of the work he was doing, including sitting in on calls where this was relevant, why there wasn't a more aggressive action taken from the beginning. But John Spicer still defended those decisions and said, you know, the president made appropriate decisions at the appropriate time, was sort of the thrust of what he was saying.
Wasn't she about to tell somebody something right when the president dismissed her because of her stance on the immigration policy?
Well, yeah, the timeline is actually really interesting in that regard because, you know, as I said, this is one of the things that became clear in the testimony. We found out that the days in which she was sort of expressing these concerns from the intelligence community and the Justice Department about Michael Flynn were the same days that the travel ban was sort of hitting the courts. And yes, you know, the reason that was stated for her firing was that she refused to defend the travel ban in court. And she, you know, talked about that a little bit yesterday, too, about how she felt it was not constitutional and thus she couldn't send lawyers out there to defend it, you know, responsibly.
Right.
That happened the same day as she was talking to the White House counsel. And so she wasn't able to follow through on some of the questions that the counsel had because she was let go. And so she actually, during the testimony, made clear that there was something she doesn't know in terms of how the White House followed up and requested from DOJ because she was already gone and cut off from the whole process.
Yeah. Senator Blumenthal said that if not for his for the public disclosures that you and I are discussing, Michael Flynn might still be sitting in the White House. I don't know if Sean Spicer responded to that or not, but when I heard that, I thought, oh, hell yeah, he'd still be there. If we did not know this, I'm not sure the president is of a disposition where he would have dismissed him. Maybe I'm underestimating the gravity of this, but I wonder if you have any comment or any information on that.
Well, you know, as press secretaries do, I think Sean Spicer engaged in some verbal gymnastics around this issue. He was certainly asked about it. You know, the stated reason for why Michael Flynn was asked for his resignation was that he lied to Mike Pence. Now, we still don't have a very good answer as to why the concern over that lie only came to a head after the press reported that it was the fact and not necessarily when the White House was first aware that it might be the fact. You know, this is something that the White House is going to continue to be asked. And, you know, there are a lot of people in Washington who are not big fans of Michael Flynn and never were. And in fact, the knives were out for him sort of from the beginning, from some of even the Republican establishment in Washington, D.C. There are a lot of folks in D.C. who are very happy to see his replacement, McMaster, come in. And so, you know, there's going to be pressure to continue to answer these questions for days, if not weeks or months, as the Russia investigation continues, because it's not just Democrats who are pressuring the White House on this timeline and on these decisions that were made.
Understood. Tal, the problem would be that General Flynn could have been compromised. She was so concerned about this when she found out some of the things that she did that she wasn't confident that she could safely talk about it over the telephone. She had to meet with officials in a secure room. Was there any evidence, though, that, in fact, he was compromised, that policy was changed or altered, or that the Russians maybe have something on us or on him as a result of this? Was he compromised?
It's not clear. You know, there was concern that he could be, as I think the extent to which she spoke. And, you know, there are absolutely things that she was not willing to describe, one, in a unclassified setting, and two, regarding an active investigation. And so there were several no comments. And, you know, she would say, I can't comment on that, and I don't want you to interpret me not being able to comment on that. So there's a lot we still don't know.
How Comey-ish of her.
Yes, well, that Justice Department, they're very careful. But, you know, there is still an active investigation by the Justice Department and FBI about, you know, the potential links between Russia and the Trump campaign. And so I don't know that we'll know definitively until that investigation is concluded what the evidence actually looks like. But, you know, again, one of the things that the government screens for when they're looking at things like giving people clearances or, you know, allowing them security information, is they're looking for the potential to be compromised, because, you know, there are things that they would rather you admit in your interview, even if they're, you know, sort of potentially damaging character issues, than lie about. Because the biggest concern for government officials in giving someone a clearance is if they are prone to lying, then they have something to cover up, and that makes them vulnerable to blackmail. That's just a general statement about security clearances. So it's possible that even if he wasn't compromised, the concern may have been if enough material is gathered against him or there's potentially something he doesn't want coming to light, that's a, you know, sort of red flag even before it's acted on.
Yeah.
Again, speaking in generalities.
One last question. What was the lie that Flynn told? What got him in trouble here? I mean, to Pence or anybody else? Was it about money? Was it about his speaking? Was it about his other communications with officials before the election? What was it that he did that was wrong?
Right. You're getting at the fact that there are several issues swirling about. But, you know, the biggest problem is that Mike Pence went on the Sunday shows and said definitively that there was no contact, you know, as had been suggested by Flynn and Russian officials. And then it came to light and that he had not discussed anything related to Russian sanctions. Well, that did not match what had actually been surveilled in his conversations with Russian officials. And so not only was it that Mike Flynn had misled the vice president about his conversations with Russian officials, but then Mike Pence used that information to go on TV and sort of declare definitively what the truth was, when in fact it was not the truth. And so it was that sort of double whammy of not only misleading the vice president, but then allowing him to go in public and say something
TV.
That was wrong.
And is there a transcript of what Flynn was saying in this inadvertent surveillance? Do we actually know what was said between him and those Russian officials?
There is a transcript or a write-up. I don't think we know the full contents of it. That's something the intelligence community has and has briefed others on.
Well, I'd like to know what that says.
Yes, I think you and me both and a lot of folks in Washington.
But, I mean, it's possible that it's benign, too, right?
Well, yeah, certainly. I mean, there's a lot of questions here. You know, there are some laws that prohibit certain kinds of, you know, implications of being able to change policy with foreign officials, but prosecutions under that statute are extremely rare, if not non-existent. You know, so it's not necessarily improper that something was discussed. The big question is whether Flynn in any way implied or told Russian officials that, you know, policies would be changed in their favor.
Sure, I get that. But do you understand my point? But it's also possible that that didn't happen. It's also possible that there was no quid pro quo.
Absolutely. That's the flip side, is, you know, that's the concern. But there's no clear evidence that that is what happened. It does seem that the sanctions that were placed on Russia came up, and Flynn had denied that they came up
right.
at all. And that is what concerned officials. But you're right. We don't know the full picture of how these conversations unfolded, who brought up what, you know, what exactly was said.
Nice to talk to you this afternoon. Tal Copen writes for and reports for CNN Politics, previously of Fox News Chicago and ABC 7 in Chicago. Is that right?
That's right. I miss it.
Yeah, you should. It's lovely. Not here today, but do come visit with us sometime. And thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Tal Copen from CNN. Scott Simon's in the studio in a minute. His book is My Cubs, A Love Story. Or is it Cubs, My... No, it'd be My Cubs, A Love Story, not Cubs, My, A Love Story. Anyway, he wrote this book, and he'll join us next here on WGN. Scott Simon is the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, Peabody and Emmy Award winner among his 8 books. You may have read his bestseller, Unforgettable. His latest is My Cubs, A Love Story. If a smallish 145-page book can be wide-ranging, this one is. Ultimately, it is about his personal journey as a fan to last year's Cubs World Championship. But along the way, he tells you about his friends and family and his personal connections to the game. One-time Cubs manager Charlie Grimm, immortalized by Norman Rockwell, sitting glum on the bench, was a close enough family friend he called him Uncle Charlie. And longtime Cubs announcer Jack Brickhouse was his godfather. He's on a first-name basis with the people who make cheeseburgers at the Billy Goat and Eli's Cheesecakes, too, and they all make cameos in this book. And when he writes sparingly about his father's alcoholism, you want not only the Cubs to win, but the Simons to win, too, as if the happiness for one cannot come without the happiness for the other. The book has a few line drawings, no pictures, anecdotes about the old Cubs you do not know, and feelings from last year you do not want to forget. Scott Simon is in our studio.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much. It was a very nice introduction. Thank you. I know a little bit about reading introductions to authors. That was a nice one. Thank you.
This is a good book.
Thank you. Nice of you. And you said smallish. I like to say shortish. I think that doesn't depress sales if you say it's a short book. You know, nobody, oh, okay, that doesn't sound so bad.
I know. I read the whole thing all by myself. But, you know, it almost must be daunting because anybody and everybody can write a book about the Cubs World Series run. Everybody's talked about it and written the essays about it and cried about it. So when you said, okay, I'm going to do my version of it, did you almost try and convince yourself not to? It's almost cliche to do the Cubs book.
Yes. And I, you know, honestly, there are people who are greater students of the game and report sports as a regular beat who I think are, I hope I give a good accounting. I've covered a lot of wars. I've written a lot of histories. I hope I can recount a narrative. But that being said, I think great professional sports reporters, that's their domain. What I was trying to do was give some idea about the character and the history of the team and, the mentality of those of us who are Cubs fans, because it's not... It's lovable losers, but yet it's something else. I mean, I think, speaking for myself, I never had, did I have some bad moments when I was, I think I described crying in the bathroom at one point, and I think I've cried a lot about the Cubs over the years. But it really is a love story in that, every now and then you get a little frustrated and disappointed and, slam the door and say, I've had it with you. I'm never, but then a few minutes later you're knocking on the door and saying, oh, come on, honey, I didn't mean anything that I said. And it's got all those gradations of a love story, you know?
How important was it to you, or how meaningful was it to you, winning it last year?
Meaningful is the word. Important, I would have spent a couple of days in a very foul mood, and no doubt I would have cried, and I would have had a hard time explaining it to our daughters, but I live a blessed life, and I would have gone on. One of the great advantages to being a Cubs fan, I think, is that it's Chicago. We know we're a great city, Chicagoans. We don't need to win a World Series to feel a great sense of accomplishment.
We're not Cleveland.
Well, I didn't want to say that because I sell books in Cleveland too. But in any event, yes, absolutely. Not a city, and I'm very happy for Cleveland and for LeBron and for the Cavaliers. I think that's great. Chicago's got a different frame of mind. And this was definitely the north side of Chicago and the team and the community. Meaningful is the word, because I think it reminds us, on top of everything else, that we can break these mentalities in life, these unhealthy psychologies, if that's what it is. There is progress, there is improvement, because I think a lot of us who are Cub fans were getting into a very unhealthy mentality, where we wanted to keep the team in some kind of timeless diorama, almost like a museum piece, not a real baseball franchise. You know, we wanted to keep it with the scoreboard and no video. And
you think part of the identity was losing?
I'm afraid so, or at least creating the conditions that provide for loss. And look, I can't tell you how many people I've run into since then, I've been on book tour with the book, who say, "What will you Cub fans do now that you've won?" And my short answer is, we'll enjoy it, I guess. That's what it's been so far. I really don't think that's going to detract from our identity as Cubs fans.
Well, was it Tom Ricketts or Theo Epstein who said about that, "I don't know, let's figure it out"?
Yeah, Tom Ricketts said
that. The fans deserve this question.
Yeah,
let's not win, because we're so steeped in the lovable losers. Now what'll happen?
Yeah,
are we going to be a run-of-the-mill good team? That's not as interesting as being the perennial losers.
And I do think also they put every element into place to be one of the perennial good teams.
Yeah, last couple days.
It's been hard to say on the series with the Yankees, but yeah. I do think, look, the hardest thing to do in professional sports, I'm convinced, is to repeat a championship, particularly in this day and age when personnel, of course, change all the time. Even though a lot of the Cubs stars are under relatively long-term contracts. Obviously, there are other teams have figured out what you've done. They want to demonstrate that they know the alchemy, too. They think they've got your riddle. You see a series like the Yankees, where I think the Yankees feel a great sense of they really proved something by sweeping the Cubs in 3 weeks. So it's very hard to repeat a championship.
You say a couple things in the book that really surprised me. One was about curses, generally, some specifically. Yeah. You also said something about crime in Chicago that quite surprised me in the book. I want to ask you about that in a minute. Scott Simon's in our studio. My Cubs, a love story.
Go Cubs, go!
238.
Go Cubs, go! Hey, Chicago, what do you say? The Cubs are gonna win.
Thank you, Steve Bertrand. This is John Williams. Go, we're in the Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue. And Scott Simon, My Cubs, a love story, is in our showcase studio talking about his new book, which is about last year's championship run and what it was like for this super Cubs fan to live through it. And there's just a lot of interesting sort of sidebar notes, none of which you dwell on at any great length, but which you give me pause. How important it was to your father, what it was like for the two of you, what it was like for your wife and your long-suffering wife, maybe, and
17 years, and she's been suffering every minute of it, I'm sure. but she suffered first and last because she's married to me, not because she's a Cubs fan.
Well, but there were just moments where she seems to – she makes appearances in your book as the sort of consoling or understanding person, or the sort of teammate of yours who's going through it as well.
Yes, very much so. And then every now and then, of course, she's a voice of reason, or more than every now and then in our marriage, certainly. But she's the one that – for example, I was about to go to the White House, where there was this wonderful President Obama greeted the world champion, said, "I now get to say something. No, none of my predecessors have said, welcome to the White House World Series champion Chicago Cubs." And I was about to leave, and I had on the Chicago Cubs scarf I'm wearing today, John, on the street. And I had it on, and I said, "Well, I'm okay. I'm going to go, darling." And she said, "Oh, darling," my wife is French, "oh, darling, do not go to the White House dressed like a doofus." And I took off the scarf. I get through security. I get into the White House. First person I run into that I recognize is Senator Durbin of Illinois. You know what he's wearing?
A doofus scarf?
Exactly. The same Cubs scarf that I left at home. So she's often the voice of reason.
I think your wife would appreciate a man wearing a scarf. That's very French.
It is very French, but not that scarf. It's not an Hermes item. But I went to the 3 games here in Chicago. They lost the first two. I was on my way to the park for the 3rd game, and I suddenly realized, what if I'm the problem? And I called my wife, and I said, shouldn't I sell my ticket to these deeply unscrupulous people on the street? We'll be a little bit ahead of our daughter's tuition,
and
they'll stand a chance of winning. And my wife, as the voice of reason, said, no, because if you don't go and they lose, you'll blame yourself for not being there. You'll want to be there to console everybody. And she said, if they win, you can never see another Cubs game as long as you live. So she was right, and thank God they won.
I laughed out loud and then made a note, laughed out loud in the margins of the book when you said, as only a Cubs fan, maybe I'm the problem. And I thought, oh, God, that is so us.
That's real
fandom. And that is so ridiculous.
Of course it is, but... Of course, but that's the mentality of being a fan, which I try and write about in the book because, you know, as I take it curse by curse. And I do think, by the way, that Cubs fans sometimes have been culpable in some of the failures of the franchise.
Well, that was the point I wanted to get to. I mean, so you if there is such a thing as a curse, you think it's been self-inflicted more than once?
Yes. I think, for example, of shorthand, the Stephen Bartman incident, which I shouldn't call it because, you know, all he did was act like a fan. But in any event, I think it was less that he may or may not have interfered with Moises Alou trying to catch that ball. I think the problem was Moises Alou slapped his glove on the ground and the crowd reacted. They began to chant very ugly things at Steve Bartman. And I think that's what set off the mentality. You could see the club got tight after that. I think all these players who had grown up and said, I don't believe in curses. I'm too young for that. I'm the best player to ever come out of my home. I don't believe in curses. I'm a winner. I think when that happened, they began to think, oh, maybe there is something to this curse. So I blame us fans for that.
It's almost as if Moises Alou said, it's happening. It's happening.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's only happening because we are doing it to ourselves.
And I like Moises Alou, but if he had just gone back to his position in left field and, you know, okay, we'll pick it up from here, I think they would have stood a better chance.
I refuse to, for the longest time, and as a rule, try not to refer to the foul ball guy by name because he so covets his anonymity.
Yeah,
and I think he is a singular character in that, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's not tried to profit on it. You talk about this.
Yes, I'm very noble. I like him.
I think all we know about him is that he is that, noble, by his absence.
Yeah.
There's something that is not trading on this, you know, unfortunate moment for him. I don't know if he's been to a game since. Do you?
I don't know that, no. I'm told he's still a fan, but I don't know if he's been to a game.
You also were very angry at the fans and said at the end of the telling in your book of the foul ball guy incident, and you say it's an incident, that we didn't deserve to win the World Series that year.
Yes, I think that.
Those are harsh words, Mr. Simon.
Because I think we set off the train of events that that got the Cubs tight and may have led to them losing the games, the two games, actually. We have to remember there was one after that that kept us out of the World Series, if I might say us. I also think, and I just got a glancing reference to this, that was the year of Sammy Sosa. I know I gave my heart totally to Sammy Sosa, without skepticism, without restraint. And, I blame him for that. But looking back on it, I think we allowed ourselves to be hornswoggled.
You also look back to 1969. And the way you talk about that, I thought was really interesting. I didn't know some of the sidebar notes that you introduced us to along the way. But you're still mad at Leo Durocher for 69.
Well, I wrote a book a number of years ago about Jackie Robinson. And actually, Leo was the manager when Jackie Robinson first came up to the Brooklyn Dodgers. And I will say this. He played a genuinely admirable role because he called a team meeting and said to the Dodgers, some of whom were talking about striking, he said, I don't care if I might have to be careful not to use Leo's exact words, but he said, I don't care if a guy is red, black, blue, or has stripes like a so-and-so polka-dotted zebra. This guy can play, and he can help us win, and so far we haven't won blank yet. He stared down that rebellion, and he played a genuinely admirable role. That being said, I think he worked the Cub pitching staff in particular too hard in 1969. They won a lot of games early when people weren't figuring that they were in the mix at that point, so that when they needed the gas in the tank, they didn't have it, particularly in the warm months of August and September.
So even though the Mets were hard charging it, and when you remind us that was when Nolan Ryan was a rookie.
Yeah.
I mean, my goodness.
It was a great pitching staff. Tom
right.
Seaver,
it wasn't
Nolan
like,
Ryan and Gary Gentry, yeah.
Right. So it sort of validates it from the Mets perspective, if you will. But it does remind me a little bit about what happened to the Cubs in 03. Don't people think Dusty Baker overused Kerry Wood, particularly?
Kerry Wood and Mark Pryor, yes. I think that's part of the story, as a matter of fact. And Dusty Baker's a great manager, and he's done well, obviously, with the Nats, although not that well yet. But in any event, I think, look, it's easy for us to judge that from the outside. But I also think that, you know, we, particularly here in Chicago, there is that close relationship between the fans and the club and the neighborhood. I think our reaction counts for something in a way it doesn't in other cities.
Yeah. So when it started to rain in the seventh game, did you just think, oh, my God, it is happening?
Oh, I'm afraid so.
It is happening again. This is too bizarre. Oh. This is our black cat.
It's true. We live on the East Coast. though Hart here, of course. We live on the East Coast. I'd been to the three games here. I had to pick up. This was in the middle of the election campaign, you know, and ostensibly, John, as I don't have to tell you, I was reporting on that too. We sent our daughters to bed, promising we'd wake them up when the game resumed. But I didn't, because I had such a bad feeling about what would happen. I didn't want to wake up our daughters when the game resumed, have them see the Cubs lose, and have some of the same blight and darkness in their lives with which I'd grown up. So my wife and I agreed on a strategy. We won't wake up our daughters. And, that, you know, figuring, well, if they lose, they won't be there to witness the disgrace. If they win, what a wonderful way to wake up. And I did, in fact, wake up our daughter at 2:30 in the morning. And she wasn't surprised. She said, oh, I knew they'd win.
Jack Brickhouse was your godfather.
Yes. I'm able to cock my head and take a look at a bronze statue there over here.
And that was before you were Scott Simon.
That was before. Well, it was my name, but yes, it was before anybody knew me. It was a kid, yes.
I mean, you were destined to write this book. Charlie Grimm was your quote-unquote uncle. I mean, he was married
to my Auntie Marion. Yeah. He was, I think, my Auntie Marion's third. I'm sorry, my plug has come undone. Mm. He was married to my Auntie Marion, third. He was actually also... Oh, never mind that. He was a great left-handed banjo player. My Auntie Marion was a lounge singer. And he was the last manager of the Cubs of time before last they were in the World Series in 1945. So, Uncle, can I do something that I don't get to do on NPR? Okay.
You're going to cuss now. Go ahead.
No. Because you can't do that here. Okay, Uncle Jack's home run call, which I'm pleased to say a lot of people still remember. Ready?
Yeah.
That's it. Back. Hey, hey, all the way out on Waveland Avenue. That was his home run call. And a woman in New York years ago told me that when men from the north side of Chicago achieve romantic fruition, they have a habit of yelling out, hey, hey. And I told that to Uncle Jack, and he thought it was the greatest ratification of his life's work that he ever heard. To the day he died, he kept saying to me, you keep saying hey, hey now, kid. You keep saying hey, hey. Where do I plug this in? And I mean
yeah,
the...
Elif's going to run in here. Hey, Elif, he just...
Oh, that's all right.
What are you, a rookie? Do you not know how radio stations
work? I know. I'm
work?
Sorry. I tried the... I was about to say... Oh, see? Huh? Huh?
This
see?
Is the difference between...
That's all right.
WGN Radio and NPR. At NPR, there's 72 people working on your show that will immediately take care of
right,
it.
Right, exactly. Here, they bring the plug in on a velvet pillow, as a matter of fact, and they have the
me and Elif.
See, that doesn't work. Here we go. Thank you very much. They bring the plug in on a velvet pillow, and they say, "How's the audio, Mr. Simon? Can I get you a cappuccino, Mr. Simon?" Yeah, it's a little different work environment than what you have here.
One last thing. Yeah. You talk a little bit about your dad in this book. Not a yeah. lot. Well, two last things, and yeah. now we're running short of time.
That's right.
The Cubs were important to him.
Yes.
And your dad was important to you. Yes. Can you just talk a little bit about the triumvirate of you, your dad, the Cubs, and maybe it's a four-legged stool, and yeah. his drinking?
Yeah, my father was a problem drinker. I've written and talked about that before. It's no secret to anybody in Chicago who, in a sense, knew it before I did growing up. We would go to a place just a few steps from here, Billy Goat Tavern, because we lived in a kind of, forgive me, ramshackle hotel around the corner. It was then called the St. Clair. And we would watch games in the middle of the afternoon, and my father would have something to drink. Or we would go at night when they were on the road, night games. And I think for a lot of people, the Cubs... And our love of the Cubs was a language that we shared when we didn't want to talk about anything important, when in a way we couldn't talk about anything important. But we could feel that we were united in the same love when we watched the Cubs together. And that meant the world to me, still does.
Could it have been the Bears? Could it have been a singer? Could it have been something else that unites people?
Yes, and I will say on Bear Game Sundays, we shared that experience too. But that's, you know, 10, 12 games a year. Baseball is day after day. And you make a place for it in your life that you don't in any other major sport.
Yeah. The other thing, I'll take a break if you'll give me two more minutes.
Please, yes.
And that is, why did you include then a passage towards the end of the book about the murder rate in Chicago, the shootings and the murders? Scott Simon's in our studio. My Cubs, A Love Story is his latest. This is W. Scott Simon's book is My Cubs, A Love Story, the host of NPR's Weekend Edition. So towards the end of this book, mm-hmm. you were describing, obviously, what joy we had in Chicago after the Cubs won. But then you took a little detour and talked about the murder and shooting rates in Chicago. Why?
Because I and maybe this is my background as someone who obviously doesn't usually write books about sports, but is ostensibly in the news business. I thought it was wrong to remember 2016 as just the year that the Cubs won the World Series, because I think the homicide rate here has been a sadness and a tragedy, and I say this as a loyal Chicagoan, a disgrace. And I think we can't, and not over, by the way. And I think I think we have to remember 2016 as a year with that alarming increase in homicides. And I hope one day we can have a parade, something on the scale that the Cubs had, when we can observe that we've been able to put an end to that. And I don't like the way, John, that it's been politicized. I don't like the way that President Trump, I think, tries to use it as to say that, you know, the Democrats can't run anything, you know, even in President Obama's backyard. I also don't like people on the other side that say, look, the homicide rate is lower actually than it was in the 1990s, and it's worse in per capita in New Orleans and Detroit, and I believe even Washington, D.C. This is one of the great, I think it's the greatest city in the world, and I have been around the world, and we shouldn't have that. I think we're better than that, and I think it's every great resource that there is in the city of talent and genius and accomplishment, now including baseball, should figure out something they can do to be part of a solution.
This will sound trivial then, yeah, but against the backdrop of the election and what you just said, it made the Cubs win that much more, I don't know, cathartic is not the right word, but pleasant.
I think that's true. You know, and President Obama said the same thing at the White House. President Obama, and he was terrific that day, and I found out later.
Great ad lib, yeah.
Yes, found out later he had ad libbed his own remarks, the ones that particularly impressed me. And he said, look, a lot of people wonder, why do we care about sports? And he said, I'm standing here as president in part because of what Jackie Robinson achieved and because of what Ernie Banks meant to the north side of Chicago, and not just the north side of Chicago. And he said, it's a common ground, it's a common language.
And he used the word, was it you or was it his speechwriter or was it the president himself who used the word joy?
He said joy. He absolutely. He said our town became, in that moment, he was talking about the parade here, with millions of people. He said, in that moment, our town became the epitome of joy, did he say, or the evocation of joy?
Here's you writing his quote. You've about got it memorized. Millions of people, the largest gathering of Americans that I know of in Chicago. And for a moment, our hometown becomes the very definition of joy.
Yeah.
And that's what it was like. It was weird, though, too, wasn't it? Because you almost couldn't enjoy it, at least not the NLCS and really the World Series.
It was too nerve-wracking.
It was really, in fact,
yeah.
You know, wake your daughters up now and tell them, here, I've got it on tape. Watch it now. I promise you that we're going to win and it's going to be awesome. You can enjoy every minute of it, because there were times we clearly did not.
Yeah, yeah. I certainly felt that way, which is why we didn't wake up our daughters. But they were very happy when they found out.
Well, tell them to read the book now. It's lovely. It's my Cubs.
All of my books, they just open it up to see their names in the acknowledgments, and that's about all the interest that they have in it, you know. One day I hope they give, if they give any of my books a good read, it'll be this one.
My Cubs, a Love Story is a good one. Scott Simon, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bro, I specifically told you, if we're on the air and you want to come in, you just come right in. You just throw the guest out or come barging in, and
I get that kind of sway around here.
So considerate of you guys to wait outside the studio before we finish.
Wasn't that nice?
And now I'm a little late in getting to you. My apologies.
No.
That's all right.
No problems. We have many things that we need to deal with today. Brett Baer is going to be joining us on Fox News Channel coming up at 3:40. We've got Mark Sapelsa, who's going to be joining us from the WGN-TV at 3:20. And we got Tom Skilling coming our way at 3:50. That just starts your show. And I should mention this. Taya Kyle is going to be with us. She and Richard Roper are actually doing an event this weekend here in Chicago. Taya Kyle is the widow, of course, of Chris Kyle. And Chris Kyle, of course, the American Sniper, the movie was made about him, and all an amazing, amazing story of his life, and then his bizarre and untimely death.
They could do another book about the trial then afterwards too, the whole Jesse Ventura thing and all that.
Yeah, so it's a very crazy thing. So we will So all that's good. That's coming your way at 4:40, by the way. So that's those are all the things that are.
And then we
to
have
print.
To talk about the superbug too, Raul, which is impacting
yes.
people.
I've already. I'm in. As you'll notice mm-hmm. now, John, as you look at me, I am in a beekeeper outfit and I have my own oxygenator on. I'm not.
Don't touch him.
Don't come near me. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm saying is that there's a pandemic heading our way.
Yes. Don't breathe the air around him.
Pandemic. All right.
We're going to have, actually, Violetta is going to start doing pandemic traffic. It's just sort of about where the hot spots. That's going to be her next
Fair enough.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to get out of the studio before I get it. Then.
Yeah. All right.